I'd like to open committee meeting for the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. Thank you all for being here. We've got a pretty full schedule today, and I wanted to make a couple of announcements so people understand which way we're going. If you see at the bottom of your agenda, there's a possible work session, 2190, is that one? We will not be hearing that bill today, and it'll have to be further notice regarding any additional meetings, so that one will be taken off today. Mm-hmm. We will start in just a moment with House Bills 2082 and 2950. I'll open simultaneous hearings on those. Most of our members are here except for Representative Thompson. He will be excused for the first hour and then docked in pay after that. But many of you don't know he's a master chef, and he's a judge at a chocolate cake contest at some high school.
What?
And it's a very tough duty that we wish him well, and he'll be back.
You bringing the cake back?
Well, he's
not
better.
There, yeah.
Need more judges?
So that's his story, and he's sticking to it. And so with that, unless there's any other comments or agenda item, I will proceed. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2082, and I'd like to open a hearing on House Bill 2950. And before we have our first witness up, I'd like for our committee administrator to give us a little background on both. Liz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2082, if passed, would give the director of the Department of Environmental Quality the authority to approve certain settlement agreements through consent judgments or administrative agreements relating to the release of hazardous waste. And House Bill 2950 would give the director of the Department of Environmental Quality the authority to provide persons with covenants not to sue concerning future liability relating to the release of hazardous waste.
Thank you. Again, remind everyone that we will be, both bills are open for hearing. I suppose that we'll focus a little more on 2150, but testimony on either or is welcome. I'd like to call our colleague, Representative Lou Frederick, up. This 2950, he's a one of the chief, if not the chief sponsor, I'm not sure, but we're happy to have you, and if you'll identify yourself, we're eager to hear from you, Lou.
Thank you very much.
Hello, folks. How are you?
Thank you for inviting me. As you mentioned, Chair Gilliam and Chair Cannon, I'm Lou Frederick. I'm with House District 43, North and Northeast Portland, and I bring an issue before you that's been in front of me for decades, actually about three decades. I live just three blocks from an identified brownfield, a small contaminated site, the site of both a former service station and a dry cleaner. It's unusable for anything as it exists today. It's been that way for a very long time. Now, I don't bring this up because of one eyesore in my own community neighborhood, but I'm going to show you a couple of pictures here if we can get this to work. There we are. Resume slideshow. All right. This is the site. You'll see that with the information that I'm going to be handing out that we have sites like this all over the state. This is a few pictures of that particular site and several others, and we also have maps of two of your districts showing sites in the DEQ database, both past and potential cleanup sites. In my district, note the contact number there, it's 911, that's what you're supposed to call for this. There are about 150 of these sites in my district. Some of them have already undergone cleanup, but many others are sites that are either confirmed or to be contaminated or, based on their history, carry a high suspicion of contamination. This is not just an aesthetic problem, although it's that. It's not just an environmental problem, although it's definitely that, and one with immediate and localized consequences. These sites are also missing in action in terms of economic activity. They can't be used for homes. They can't be used for business. They can't even be used for the functions they had in the past. When I was growing up, gas stations were everywhere, in urban, suburban, and rural communities, complete with underground storage tanks. Many of those tanks are still there, leaking, or have leaked into the ground over a long period of time. You'll notice that the LUST sites referenced on the handouts are those are leaking underground storage tanks, despite what some of you might want to think on that. Photo finishing involved toxic chemicals, and those shops were fairly common. Dry cleaners used more toxic chemicals than they do now, and they didn't dispose of them the way that we now understand they should have. Even in the early 80s, I witnessed a mechanic pouring solvents into the soil behind his shop. He told me he had always done it that way, and this is the shop that I'm talking about, actually. He told me he had always done it that way. There were also farm chemicals in places where using pesticides were stored and disposed of in ways that we just don't do now. We prohibit it for very good reasons. We know better. But the main point I want to get across is that these sites could be used for economic activity. They exist in residential, commercial, agricultural, and industrial areas. They can be returned to use without zoning changes and with only a positive impact on the neighborhood uses. Now even the vacant ones are useless, even as open space, because they're toxic. We could have infill in urban areas without a perceived increase in density. We could provide land for manufacturing or commercial establishments without encroaching on other uses. This is frankly a reservoir of available space. It may take a variety of legislative and administrative actions to remove barriers to appropriate cleanup of these sites. I'm told that uncertainty at various stages represents perhaps the biggest barrier to rehabilitating these sites. There's uncertainty as to the cost of the cleanup, and a business can spend a lot of money just to finding out what the appropriate cleanup will entail. There's also uncertainty as to the ability to attach an endpoint for liability for contamination, and this is a major deterrent to potential purchasers of properties that may have been contaminated by the previous owners, and often those owners and those businesses are now defunct. That's the barrier I had in mind when I introduced House Bill 2950. We need to give prospective private purchasers some certainty about what they're getting into. This is not about some kind of amnesty for polluters. It's about giving innocent purchasers a clear path. If we can sort this all out, we can get one of those win-wins we're always talking about. A win for the environment and a big win for the economy. This is a way to support businesses of all sizes and the jobs they create. Now, I'm not the only one interested in this issue, and I'm not invested in a particular proposal. My original bill was modeled after legislation passed in Pennsylvania, but I've been working with the DEQ to build on the programs they already have, and with representatives of the City of Portland and the Port of Portland, two jurisdictions that are clearly affected by this problem, and we're crafting an approach that will produce results, and that's better tailored to Oregon. We have come to an agreement on language to bring forward. We'll get that to you as soon as the Legislative Council has completed the drafting. I now want to introduce Director Dick Peterson of the DEQ and David Ashton of the Port of Portland and Dan Eisenbeiss of the City of Portland, who will have some more detailed information for you and can answer your technical questions. That's all right. They're right behind me.
Thank you, Representative. And you obviously want us to go ahead, and then we can ask questions of all of you.
That would be great.
Okay. And you're welcome to stay. We hope you do. But if you've got a committee yourself, you're welcome.
I will do that. All right. Let's see. That happens to be... Oh, that's not my district. That's 46.
Okay.
Where is Dan?
You see that?
I do. I recognize that.
How did you sneak that in there?
Thank you, Representative.
Shameless promotion. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Director?
Yes. Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here to discuss how House Bill 2082 and 2950 relate to improving Oregon's environment and economy. Both bills are intended to encourage the redevelopment of contaminated properties. These are properties that pose environmental problems for our communities, including direct threats to public health, as an example, contaminating drinking water supplies. Also, these properties can be lost opportunities that when you have ignored or abandoned properties that are contaminated often sit for years without any investment or economic growth. Of course, this means less property tax revenue and fewer jobs for our communities. There are certainly clear environmental and economic reasons to encourage the redevelopment of these properties. To illustrate the scope of what we're dealing with, I believe we're going to hand out some maps here that are two maps showing the environmental cleanup sites in the co-chair's districts, just so you can get an idea of what they are. These maps show both the urban and rural opportunities that exist that exist for economic development and environmental cleanup. And when you look at these maps, just so that you know, there's a scope of projects that are on those. Ones are those that have been cleaned up, and you can't distinguish by looking at it. It's just how many there are. Some that have been cleaned up, some that we're actively working on, and some that are suspected to be potential problems, which sort of defines brownfields. Mm-hmm. And so it just gives you an idea. And if anyone would like a map of their of sites in our district, we're happy to provide that. Both House Bill 2082 and 2950 address a significant piece of the redevelopment puzzle, and that's concern over legal liability. The issue of legal liability can cast a chill over the development of contaminated properties. Understandably, businesses and investors want certainty before investing in a piece of property, but the risk of potential lawsuits is not easily quantified. So both House Bill 2082 and 2950 are intended to provide some of the certainty for this legal risk and thus encourage redevelopment in contaminated properties. Since Representative Frederick has addressed House Bill 2950, I want to focus the rest of my brief remarks on the DEQ legislation, House Bill 2082. House Bill 2082 is primarily intended to provide liability protection to what we call the innocent purchaser. This is someone who is not responsible for contamination on the site and who signs an agreement with DEQ before purchasing the property. These agreements, known as prospective purchaser agreements, require the innocent purchaser to undertake a cleanup at the site. Provided that there is substantial compliance with the agreement, the innocent purchaser is not liable to the state of Oregon for contamination on the property at the time of purchase. We've done more than 100 of these prospective purchaser agreements across the state with great success. We've signed agreements with developers, investors, to clean up small corner lots to large industrial properties. What is unique about House Bill 2082 is that DEQ is proposing to extend the liability protection to include lawsuits from third parties. Since an innocent purchaser is not responsible for contamination on the site, it seemed very appropriate to extend this protection to them. If a third party, such as a neighbor, is damaged by contamination, that person could certainly look to those responsible for contaminating the property if that were needed. By extending these liability protections, DEQ believes that House Bill 2082 will provide a measure of certainty to developers and investors that does not exist today. We further believe that this step should encourage greater development of contaminated properties, especially those in cases with high risk of third-party lawsuits. So, co-chairs, that concludes my remarks, and I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Co-Chairs?
Sure.
And members of the committee? My name is David Ashton. I'm an assistant general counsel with the Port of Portland in their legal department, and I specialize in environmental and natural resources law on behalf of the port, including in brownfields redevelopment at sites like our Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park and at Terminal 2 and Marine Terminal 4 and surrounding properties in the Portland Harbor. I'm also one of the port's representatives on a harbor redevelopment initiative, which is an effort led by the City of Portland Portland Development Commission to look at ways to try to enhance the redevelopment of brownfield sites in the watershed that surrounds the Portland Harbor Superfund site. The Harbor Redevelopment Initiative is basically looking to try to find ways to facilitate the brownfields redevelopment of these upland sites, looking at issues of interagency collaboration, economic incentives, regulatory streamlining, or enhancements to the liability protection available to parties considering buying or leasing some of these contaminated properties for redevelopment. The stakeholders represented in that initiative include not only the port and the city, but also the Oregon Business Development Department, Metro Multnomah County, Portland Business Alliance, the Columbia Corridor Association, Siltronic Corporation, and Advanced American Construction. We recognize that redevelopment of these sites can be perceived to be or actually are more daunting and expensive, take much more time than starting out with a vacant greenfield site. But we know at the port from experience that if you can find ways to redevelop them timely and cost effectively, then they are great economic engines for job creation and also infill development within the urban growth boundary. The port and other participants in the Harbor Ready, the Harbor Redevelopment Initiative, have approached the initiative with the goal of developing additional tools in the Brownfields Redevelopment Toolbox that could be applied to brownfield sites wherever the opportunity arises, wherever it might be in the state, however small or large or how simple or complex the site might be. And we believe that enhancements set forth in the proposed legislation could be applied to any brownfield sites, from the smallest former gas station or dry cleaners to the largest contaminated, underutilized site. One of the aspects of brownfields redevelopment that the initiative looked at was ways to improve the availability of the protections from liability that exist under DEQ's current and very helpful Section 465.327 program. It's a program that protects not only innocent buyers but also innocent prospective tenants in relation to contamination sites. We view it as a program available to innocent buyers and innocent tenants for brownfields redevelopment. Working with the stakeholders and after meeting with DEQ, our group looked at a variety of ways to enhance this program for innocent buyers and innocent tenants to basically make the brownfields transactions faster, cheaper, but nonetheless subject to the same shields from liability that can be obtained through the more formal process where you negotiate a consent judgment with DEQ that ultimately gets filed and then entered by a court. We've looked specifically at two enhancements. One, making those agreements an explicit defense to statutory direct cost recovery and damages claims that could be made. And then secondly, making the same legal protections that you can get through a consent judgment also available through an administrative consent order. The Port considers that the proposed legislation will accomplish these two objectives. First of all, it would make the entry into one of these agreements a defense to statutory liability under a variety of remedies that are available and are appropriately used against polluters. Again, here we're shielding innocent buyers and innocent tenants. Specifically, it would shield against state or third-party claims under ORS Chapter 465, dealing with hazardous substances, ORS 466, dealing with hazardous materials, and ORS 468B, dealing with oil pollution. We think that it's important to make clear that one of these agreements is a defense to these claims. We know that these theories of liabilities have been used by parties against, appropriately against polluters. I've given you some cases that show where those remedies have been recognized against polluters. We also know that if the contamination is significant enough, like in the Portland Harbor, then those theories are used against them. Potentially liable parties, and that's the Portland Harbor litigation that I've cited too. What the amendments would do is basically eliminate any uncertainty that these innocent buyers and tenants and the investors and lenders behind them will not be exposed to these kind of claims, thereby assuring the potential that these development on these sites will be successful and not undermined by the presence of pre-existing contamination. Finally, providing the equivalent protections that are available under consent judgments through the administrative consent order mechanism, specifically the legal release from liability, the covenant not to sue, a contractual promise by the state not to sue you, and the necessary language reflecting a resolution of the liability are important protections that we think are appropriate in the administrative context. So the administrative process could be faster and less expensive, and therefore, in some cases, more preferable than the more deliberate and time-consuming consent judgment process, and thereby get brownfields back into productive use earlier. And I, too, am happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Daniel.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. I'll keep my remarks brief as my fellow commenters have given you plenty of detail. City of Portland has 330 potential brownfield sites within the city limits, totaling approximately 1,400 acres. So this is an issue that the city cares very much about. These sites are blights on existing neighborhoods. There are also sites that are not contributing to the economy in any kind of productive manner. That said, this is not a Portland issue or Portland problem. These sites are found all over the state. They come in many shapes and sizes. And as David mentioned, we need to build a more robust toolbox for encouraging cleanup of these brownfield sites. To that end, the city has been engaged in the process that Mr. Ashton referenced with other governmental entities as well as private sector interests, identifying concepts that could be applied in Oregon that have not been applied yet, in addition to addressing liability issues through prospective purchaser agreements. We also have a strong interest in looking at tax credit models that have been employed quite effectively in other states such as Florida. But obstacles to brownfield cleanup in most regards boil down to obstacles regarding certainty for the private sector or lack of capacity. This is a fairly common
lack of capacity to do the cleanup.
Chair Gilliam, capacity is a euphemism for dollars in this instance.
I see. Thank you very much.
The bills that you have before you would help address the certainty side of the ledger, and certainly not provide a silver bullet for cleanup of all sites, but could make the difference in many instances. So we are supportive of moving forward with this and encourage your support. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you for all of you for testifying, and obviously one of the reasons I'm excited that Representative Frederick brought this forward is the conversation that's already started between the representative and the three people I see in front of me. Public safety is, of course, on our list, but how do you get that and get something moving? And for that, I'm grateful and I want to continue this conversation. I would say many of you know that the co-chair represents my old neighborhood. And I'm a graduate of Warner Pacific College, which is named on that site. I think one of the regulated Lust sites. So it's I'm having a hard time with the director. It's a faith-based college, and that actually, I don't know whether you put that in your catalog or not. It is regulated.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's enough of that. Are there any questions for these folks? Oh, right over here. Representative Krieger.
I've got several questions. I want to know how this is being handled compared to other things, which you know where I'm going. How many sites are we talking about, for instance, in Mr. Representative Frederick's area? He mentioned 100 or
147.
Okay, the second part of that question would be for Mr. Peterson, were those people in violation of any of DEQ rules or EPA rules?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Krieger, these sites are identified preliminary by information that comes in that they may or may be contaminated with something. So it's not strictly a violation. It's just notes there may be contamination. And so if someone wishes to sell a piece of property, it's kind of a due diligence thing to figure out if there is contamination, how it's going to be taken care of. In the case of a leaking underground storage tank, there could have been a release of a material historically that soil or groundwater might be contaminated. So it's just identified. And then if someone wants to move forward with their own cleanup or if their property transaction wants to change, usually the purchaser that comes in wants to make sure that that's taken care of. There are some sites that might be currently contaminating drinking water or something that what I might call an imminent threat or something that might be very serious that we need to get after sooner than later because people might be in harm's way, if you will.
Please. He says 140 some sites, mm-hmm. And so then I'm wondering, well, if they've been identified, have you done investigations on each of those to see if what contaminants and to what degree is it causing groundwater pollution. Have each of those had an investigation to find that out?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Krieger, no. It's been identified as maybe there's been a release in the past, but we don't go out and investigate all sites unless we're asked to get involved by a property transaction or something like that. It's just identification of potential sites that might be contaminated. And some of those on there have actually been cleaned up, further cleaned up, and some are in active cleanup. So it's a whole mixture of a whole bunch of different sites.
The ones that haven't been cleaned up, how long can they sit there in the condition they're in, contaminated, without any responsibility of cleaning them up?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Krieger, they can sit there indefinitely if that's not an imminent or serious threat and their current property owner doesn't want to sell it or whatever, and it's not a requirement that they clean it up unless they are compelled to do themselves or there's a property transaction or there's a serious imminent threat that we know about.
Representative, do you have something to add?
I do. Chair Cannon and Representative Krieger, this site that you see right here has been actually empty for 30 years. Probably 27 officially. I know because that's where I saw them pouring the solvent into the ground right there. That's where I picked up my car. So it has been empty, and it was closed shortly after for other financial reasons. And the family that owns it has a difficulty getting enough money to clean it up, as well as they're not sure exactly what they can do. At the same time, there was a situation where the family, the person who owned it, was elderly, and they didn't quite know what their next steps might be. This is not uncommon, and I can. The site here is actually, right along Martin Luther King Boulevard. And it is it's also a site that's in the process of being cleaned up, but it has sat empty for probably the last 25 years as well.
Just a second. I want to clarify the context here. Daniel, you said Portland's got 300 and roughly.
According to the data that I've seen from Portland staff from 2008, we have approximately 330 potential brownfield sites.
And when we say potential brownfield, it's the combination of the two that we see on the other chart. That's a potential brownfield, either one of those.
Yeah.
The regulated lust and the cleanup site make up this total.
Yes, Representative Gilliam, that is true. Brownfield sites are, it's kind of a broad definition. There either is a real threat to a blockage towards development, contamination, or there's a perceived threat. So something might be thought to be contaminated, and there's just not moving because of that, so it hasn't been verified potentially.
But just to continue on this, my district is quite a large district. It's spread out. I've got, according to your figures, combined, I got 180 in mine. So, Lou, Representative Frederick, you've got half of the sites in Portland are in your district. Is that right?
Well, again, I think that Chair Gilliam and co-chairs, and I think that this is an interesting, the different numbers, the ones that you see, the cleanup sites, the regulated lust sites, are two different things, and the numbers really vary. If you look at some of the DEQ data, they indicate significantly more sites in Portland than the ones that Dan has mentioned. We're going to have to find out exactly what that is. I know that one of the best ways for me to do it is just to drive around my neighborhood, around my community, and see the empty lots. And they are almost always on the corner, and they have a gas station attached to them, or they have a flat, an area that no one wants to grow anything on.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids are kept out of there. They're fenced off.
Mm-hmm.
We find that with some regularity. This is your district here, but this site right here that I'm looking at, right, the green building there is an old gas station, no longer used. The land right in front of it used to be a battery company, and we know
issues.
What the problem might be there.
Okay, that's up there. Please,
Vice Chair. I agree with where they're going, but I'm the issue we had down in Curry County that Senator Friedman spoke to you about, an 18-inch culvert being installed and some mud got thick, not rocks and a big slides, and a fine of $7,500 for people who are in their 70s seems inconsistent with what this is. And then I look at the one from Mrs. Clausen, 5 pounds of mud with a $25,000 fine. I think you need to treat everybody with more respect and the same. You did not get back to Senator Cruz and I adequately, and this will be brought up in the Ways and Means process. I'm going to support what you're doing, Representative Fredericks. I think it needs to be done, but this agency is out of control. I'm not going to vote for their budget today or ever when I'm in this building, and I'm going to do everything I can to get others to do the same thing until the governor gets some oversight.
Any other questions from the committee on these two bills?
Mr. Chairman.
Please, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is a critically important bill in terms of both economic development and our ability to put brownfields back into a good use and to make sure that they're clean and productive lands. With that said, I personally would benefit greatly from hearing from the defense bar, who may have had in the past to have to defend against environmental lawsuits, because in order, I think, for this program to work, we're going to have to make sure that we have as ironclad immunity from liability as is possible. And as I say, I, for one, would benefit from hearing from the defense bar on this. Thank you.
Duly noted, and when we address this again, we can talk about that, Mr. Co-Chair. Any comment on that or anything else from this panel? Any other questions? All right. We thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And this is a great first start on this. I appreciate it very much. With that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2082. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2950. And I'd like to welcome Master Chef Thompson back. And we are now going to open a public hearing, possible work session on House Joint Resolution 29. I'd like to first call Stephen Kefouri up to share his testimony, and then we'll move along. No? Yeah, I'm sorry. Please come up, but if you'll hold just a minute, we'll come on up, but hold your testimony. That was my mistake. You're immediately following my co-chair, and you're welcome to share the dais. You're welcome to share the dais with him. But,
okay, thanks.
And our member, Representative Bailey. That was my mistake, Mr. Kefouri. You're next. Yeah. So, Mr. Co-Chair, I'll turn it over to you.
Mr. Co-Chair, very good to see you. I'm State Representative Ben Cannon, House District 46. I will turn this presentation over to our colleague, Representative Bailey, in a couple of minutes, but I wanted to say a few words of introduction about HCR 29. You should be getting a handout. This measure would ask voters to amend Measure 76, which they passed last fall overwhelmingly. I think it passed in every county in the state. Measure 76, of course, was a continuation and a modification of Measure 66, the 15% lottery set aside for parks and rivers and wildlife. And the measure that you see before you, HCR 29, results from a process that began last summer when some legislators, including Representative Bailey and I, and other interested parties, began to look pretty closely at the petition then circulating to extend Measure 66 dollars and looked at it with some concern. I think we shared the proponents' desire to maintain the lottery fund dedication for those vital programs, but had some concerns about the way that Measure 76 proposed to structure and restructure the program. So in working with some of the proponents of the measure last summer, we reached agreement about some changes that we would ask voters to make this year to Measure 76, and those changes have been captured in the bill that's before you today. I will describe just very broadly before turning it over to Representative Bailey the concerns that we had and the changes that were made. I will say a lot of this was, for me personally, born from the experience of having served on the Natural Resources Subcommittee during the last session, where it was absolutely clear how vitally dependent our natural resource agencies are on this lottery dedication. That 15% of lottery funds has increased now to the tune of, it's now $160 million, I think, a biennium. That is a huge chunk of funding for our natural resource agencies and programs, and it's doing immensely good work on the ground in local communities, and it's vital. It was vital, in my opinion, then. It's vital, in my opinion, now that we find a way to maintain that. But if we don't, I was concerned then, and I'm concerned now, that if we don't structure that funding and those programs right, there's a risk that voters of the state will rebel and decide to send, you know, some portion of those dollars or all of those dollars to other places. I think that's the sort of tension and balance that we're trying to seek. So structural concerns with Measure 76 as passed with voters that we expressed to its proponents last summer and got agreement to try to deal with this session include concerns related to the lack of a sunset on Measure 76. So it was a 15% continued 15% dedication, lottery dedication, constitutionally dedicated, but no sunset on it. So HJR 29 contains a sunset. The lack of access that the legislature has to those funds, even in cases of an emergency. So Measure 76 provides no ability for the legislature to use that 15% lottery set aside, even if economic conditions were such that that we had a sort of vital need for those dollars. It was hard for me to explain to my constituents why we would, in a time of economic emergency, have no access to those 15% funds. So there's a mechanism to provide for that. And finally, a concern we had then that lottery funding grows in different ways than our overall lottery and general fund blend. And so at a moment, and this was true last summer, it's true now, where general fund was increasing but barely, lottery fund was increasing quite a bit more, it was challenging to explain why our natural resource programs would be have their stars hit their wagons hitched to a star that was shooting while our schools, public safety programs, and human service programs were hitched to a different star that was only barely crawling along. So we have a mechanism in here to try to deal with that. I'll turn it over to Representative Bailey to add his thoughts and describe perhaps in a little bit more depth how HJR 29 proposes to deal with those issues. I hope that the committee will consider moving pretty quickly with this measure. Our interest is in putting this before voters soon enough that we can help that we can budget accordingly for the 11-13 biennium. We will, in the absence of movement on this, we will have some real challenges in our natural resource budgets for the 11-13 biennium.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, Co-Chair Cannon. Co-Chair Cannon summed up many of the points within the history and the technical details of HJR 29 quite well. I will just add a few points to it and then look forward to questions from the committee. I would refer you to two attachments to the top sheet that was handed out underneath HJR 29. And I refer you to those as part of the history of HJR 29, which really is that this is part two in a two-step process that was a result of a number of parties with different interests coming together late last summer and early fall to reach what I thought was a complex agreement, but an agreement that really preserved the core intent of where Measure 76 was going while addressing the concerns that Co-Chair Cannon outlined. And you have before you a copy of an editorial from the Medford Mail Tribune endorsing Measure 76 and specifically referencing the agreement between the parties in its endorsement of ballot measure 76. We have this before you today to remind the public and to remind you all that this has been part of the conversation from before the election around Measure 76. And then you also have a copy of a column that an op-ed that Representative Cannon and I wrote for the Oregonian following the agreement that was reached around ballot measure 76. And it's I owe an enormous amount of thanks and gratitude to the groups that were able to come together, make that agreement, and that are now honoring that agreement. But it is imperative that we address this issue because in the absence of a fix such as the one in HR 29, we face significant impacts to natural resource agencies and potentially to the general fund in a time when we are, as all of you know, facing shortages and challenges within our budget. So the changes that HR 29 makes are, there's essentially five categories of changes. The first are really technical fixes that are around mitigating the impact to the general fund in this biennium and going forward. It includes flexibility in the share between state agency and non-state agency grants. As you probably know, under ballot measure 66, there was a distinction between capital and non-capital grants from the set aside from lottery dollars. That was changed under ballot measure 76 to be a bifurcation between state agency and non-state agency grants. The result of that change, though, is what Legislative Fiscal Office projects to be somewhere around an $8.5 million general fund impact to natural resource agencies, which, as you know, in the context of natural resource agency budgets for many of these programs is a significant impact, and some of these programs have federal implications as well and would require a general fund backfill. There's also in point two, Representative Cannon, I think, eloquently illustrated the analogy of the shooting star. And to get at that problem, we have a fund cap that ties the growth of the set aside to the lesser of either 15% of the lottery or the past biennium fund level adjusted by percentage growth of the total general fund and lottery funds. And then we have a safety valve in number three that it mirrors the Educational Stability Fund, allowing the legislature to use a portion of these revenues in times of economic crisis. I would stress that although we have been in one, they are not frequent for this state. The number of times that the triggers for the Educational Stability Fund have applied have been few, and we hope that we're not there again going forward very soon. Number four, there's a smoothing in the transition from state parks, in the increase in funding state parks to local parks. It's a matter within ballot measure 76, and this ensures that there is an abrupt threshold transition point, but more of a smoothing in that transition. And then five, the institution of a sunset, which, while it is far out in the future and in 2035, at least does set the signal that there is a measure for accountability and that it will be up to the proponents of this measure to come back and make the case to a subsequent legislature that this has been an important investment. So those are the five categories there, and look forward to taking any of your questions.
Questions for our colleagues. Representative Boone.
I have one. I've been hearing from the watershed councils, and they are not in agreement, so I'm just wondering how that figures into this.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Boone. The agreements were signed by the Trust for Public Land and the Nature Conservancy and the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, in addition to several legislators. And the talks last fall, in those talks, there was a representation that perhaps there were more groups that were involved in that process than perhaps signed on to that agreement. So at the time of that that agreement, there was a broader understanding that the conservation community was on board with the agreement as represented by the endorsement by the Nature Conservancy, Trust for Public Land, and Oregon League of Conservation Voters.
Further.
Sir, please.
So, were the watershed councils there or at the beginning of it?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Boone. There was not a representative of the Watershed Council present in the room in which the negotiation was signed. However, the groups that were involved in it had indicated to us that they were in communication with them and speaking with them and for them.
Thank you. And Planel, sorry. And that was, can you just give me a couple of dates or something when that was, or approximately? It's last year.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Boone, I don't have the exact date in front of me. I believe it was early August.
August, okay. Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue seems to be the division between the on-the-ground expenditures as reflected in the grant element of the program on the one hand and what we'll call agency salaries and other types of costs that will probably be more reflective in the 35% of the program. How does do the groups intend to, under this, ferret out how much the voter thought should go each direction? In other words, how much do you feel comfortable taking away from the grant program and giving back to the agencies? What's the standard? What's the measure? Are you thinking that the folks that voted for this were more enthused about money going to on-the-ground programs and less for agencies, because that would appear to be the 35-65 split? And if that's the case, at what point does one stop? And I need to know what the measure is of how much goes either direction.
I'll take a shot at it. I think it's very hard, first of all, to penetrate the voter's mind in terms of what they were considering or not considering when they voted for a measure. I would point out, I don't think that voters anticipated that passage of this measure would result in cuts to natural resource agency budgets. And there are a couple of programs in particular that were funded out of the capital side of the 65-35 split that LFO tells us cannot be funded out of the grants side of the Measure 76. For example, $4 million that we spend on fish screens through ODF&W. For example, another approximately $4 million on weed control through the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Programs that, if we were to superimpose Measure 76 on our current budget, would not be eligible for funding, agency programs. And I think that's the kind of concern that we have. I don't want to see those programs go away. I am concerned, based on what LFO tells us, that under Measure 76, we'd have to make that kind. We will be short the $8 million that Representative Bailey referred to.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Benz, I would echo that and add to it that I'm not sure that the distinction was drawn during the election of the choices that would have to be made around the general fund, both with regards to Natural Resource Agency's programs as well as the trade-off with other general fund supported programs like education, public safety, and health care. And I would echo the point that it's difficult to interpret the voters' intent around specific percentage shares within a ballot measure. However, I would stress to you and to the committee that the change that is envisioned in HDR 29, which is a small shift in the percentage between state agency and non-state agency grants, does not remove dedication of lottery dollars towards parks and natural resources in general. It merely shifts between state agency and non-state agency grants. So the intent of devoting these dollars towards environmental and conservation projects and programs is preserved.
Hold on. Sure. I actually understand the $4 million for fish screens and the $4 million for invasive species falling outside the scope of the 65%, 35% split contemplated in Measure 76. There's another element, though, in the proposed referral, which is the cost of administration of the grants. That's about $5.6 million that is the cost of running the OWEB program. And that is proposed to move over to the OWEB side of the ledger, which would suggest that we are going a little further than maybe the voter thought. And I'm just pointing that out because that's one of the elements of the current proposal that is hugely challenging when one goes back to one's district and says, by the way, we've reduced this program by not only the initial $6 million, that's the 52.48% the suggested arrangement would contemplate or result in, but also this additional $6 million for agency grant administration. Now, I'm going to set that issue just aside because I believe that the decision is difficult to read the voters' mind and figure out how much should go each direction. I am interested, though, in the, I voted against this measure, and I made a point in all my town hall meetings explaining that I was not enthused about a permanent dedication of these funds. So I understand the theory to ask for a sunset and also for an opportunity to invade the principal in, or the program in the event of an emergency. You can see how enthused my folks were about this because they voted against my recommendation by 69%. So I ask you then how, when we go back and suggest the non-permanent dedication, we should expect a different result.
Coach Gilliam, Representative Bentz, you raised a number of issues. Let me see if I can address a few of them. I will start with your last one first. I think it is an assumption, frankly, that is being made that perhaps voters weren't informed through editorial boards of the agreement. It may very well be the case that voters saw that there was an agreement, as evidenced in editorial boards and endorsements, and voted for it because they saw this coming. It may also not be that case. I don't think that we actually know what the intent is, and that's why we put things out before the voters so they have a chance to have their say on it. And that's why we have constitutional referrals so the legislature can't make that decision. To your point about the grant funds, Representative, I had the pleasure of sitting on the explanatory committee for the voters' pamphlet statement and on ballot measure 76. And you will note an asterisk next to my name on the explanatory committee statement for a dissent on that statement. The issue came up on the explanatory committee and was discussed at great length whether or not ballot measure 76 allowed for grant administration to be paid out of the 35% or the 65%. There was disagreement on that point, and it was not clear, and it was the intention that this was a technical fix to ensure that it was actually able to be paid out of the part of the fund that would prevent general fund impact. So that issue came up even within the context of that explanatory statement. There wasn't a clear ruling on it, and it was agreed that in order to resolve it, we would move forward to fix that portion of it.
Just one, you have a follow-up in a second here? I've got one more comment to make. Now, coming out of the substance of the bill for a second, I did want to make a comment about the editorial, because you two are quite flexible and creative, more so than I am. But one of the problems I see that has nothing to do with the substance, really, but a lot to do with public perception and the mechanics of how we work this, is how do we put a measure out that says we're for it, except it needs some help, and we're going to amend it. I don't know if that's ever been done before, but I think it's worth noting here that you did have some good support editorial-wise, and you were honest about the fact that you're not on board until we amend it. Isn't that a little confusing for the electorate to say, okay, this measure's here, and they're going to amend it after we pass it?
Yeah, I'll take a response to that, Co-Chair Gilliam. I think we were in a challenging position. I mean, the advocates, proponents of this measure have put, I think, a year, $1 million or more into signature gathering for a ballot measure. It supports some aspirations related to natural resources that I think Representative Bailey and I share. And so I was not fully satisfied with this approach, in part because it required the voters to take a leap of faith that we'd actually be able to come back in 2011 and deal with this as we proposed. But it felt like about the best we could do, short of having to oppose a measure that does some really important things.
I would add to that, Co-Chair Gilliam, that is one of the challenges of the initiative process. and that in the legislative process we have the opportunity to debate and amend and get it right, and in the initiative process we often don't. And this was an attempt to address a system that has some challenging sideboards on it.
Okay. You had a follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that I think under the current arrangement, the administrative costs of OWEB are not paid out of what's called the capital side of things, and this would move that almost $6 million number over to the 65%, now 65%, what would, if passed, be 52%. So it just seems to me that we would need to address that issue with great care. I think my emails are running 5-1 against this, although it's really complicated, I must say, and deserves a lot of thought.
Thank you. Other questions for our colleagues? If not, come on back up.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to continue with the hearing, and I'd like to invite Tom Wolf, Nan Evans, and Amanda Rich, if they're in the room, to come forward. Please begin.
Co-chairs Gilliam and Cannon, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, and Trout Unlimited was one of the original six groups that worked on this since I joined when Nan asked me to back in September of 2009. And anyway, I'm not going to go into the deal or talk anything about that. It's covered in my testimony. Trout Unlimited was not one of the three groups that signed on to this agreement, but I understand why it was done. What I want to talk about is the language in this HJR 29 that would change the percentage of money that goes between grants. I understand the split would now be 58-42%, which reduces the 65% by 7%, which, depending on who you ask, would lessen the amount of grant money by as much as $12 million. And the reason I have a problem with this is, first of all, doing restoration is an expensive business. It's not cheap. It costs a lot of money to rent backhoes and things like that. And besides protection of our native fish and wildlife, as well as protecting important sources of clean water, we have two major economic factors for Measure 76 grant funds. Number one, in 2009, ODFW commissioned Dean Runyon Consulting Group to write a report on expenditures for hunting and fishing and wildlife viewing in Oregon annually, and they came up with the fact that people in Oregon and outside Oregon spend over $1 billion a year hunting, fishing, and watching wildlife in Oregon, that for gas, lodging, restaurants, recreational, and it's a very good industry, and a lot of that money goes into rural counties where people go to hunt, fish, or watch wildlife, so it brings tremendous amount of money into those rural communities. Second thing is the whole industry of restoration. There are people out there that make a living doing restoration. For example, TU is currently involved with a project in the Nisel Farms down in the Canicum, and we use local contractors for equipment. We buy local. When we go down to do a project, we eat at local restaurants. So there's a large industry based on grants. And when I originally joined Measure 76, my purpose was to make sure that the grant part of this measure was a much larger part and became a much more important part than using funds to pay for agencies. I felt that that could be done through other monies and other processes. So in conclusion, I'd just like to say, in our current budget crisis, I understand why there is concern to protect money for education or the budgets of natural resource agencies. But I think protecting OWEB grant money that will provide economic stimulation and protection of our native fish and wildlife species is equally important. So I think why we should keep and honor the other parts of the agreement, I think it is important to keep the 65-35 original proposal established in Measure 76 and not change the proportion. The thousands of Oregonians involved in watershed councils, conservation groups, rural restoration projects, and the businesses which support the projects will benefit from the sources of grant money, as will the future of this wonderful state and all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Cannon. I am Nan Evans. I am the Director of Government Relations for the Nature Conservancy, and yes, we were one of the three signatories to the agreement that has been referenced here earlier, and I think I'll just keep my comments to that because Mr. Wolf will can talk to the substance of what a good thing this is. I will make a comment that we signed for the Nature Conservancy. In discussions at the time with the other coalition members, we explained what we were doing, and we said we were signing for the Nature Conservancy. We were not representing other organizations. That said, the Nature Conservancy does support the agreement we signed. We support the elements of it that include the growth cap, the safety valve, the sunset, and the technical fixes. However, when HJR came out earlier this month, we were surprised. One of the elements of the agreement that was not included on your summary is that we had named an attorney that we wanted to be part of the drafting, and I guess you had things else on your mind between November, December, and January, and I can certainly understand that. But anyway, that didn't happen. So when the language came out, it was a surprise to us. We had not interpreted, nor did we intend, to agree to a change in the percentages between the grants and the state agencies that would be in effect over the lifetime of the measure. In retrospect, I'll observe that probably the discussions and the language of the agreement just simply were not clear enough. The discussions weren't detailed enough, they weren't clear enough, we did not have a shared understanding of what that item meant. We do agree that there was no intent to have an impact on the general fund, and in the numbers of conversations that have been happening around the building over the last couple of weeks, we've certainly been aware that, depending on your assumptions, you can come up with a range of answers to, is there a general fund impact, and if so, what is it? Varying from the fiscal impact on the measure prepared by the treasurer was no general fund impact. The governor prepared a recommended budget that did some use of federal funds that we expect to come into the state to balance the budget with no general fund impact. And yet you can take another set of assumptions and look at the problem and come up with perhaps an $8 million. So we're aware that depending on your assumptions, you can reach a number of different conclusions. We are confident that with a little more time, with bringing perhaps a broader representation and a broader participation of some of the affected parties, we could probably reach some agreement that would avoid the unavoidable and unexpected and unanticipated impacts, that could address some of the concerns of other groups who had not been at the table, or at least discuss them. And as we then engaged the attorney that had been named in the agreement to look at the language of HJR 29, he has pointed out a number of what I would characterize as technical fixes that need to occur in the language itself to make sure that we're very clear about what the intent of the measure is, and that future legislators, and hopefully not future courts, but future legislators can understand what we did. So we would want to have a conversation to make sure that language is clear. But in summary, I want to say that the Nature Conservancy does stand by its commitments to the agreement.
Okay, thank you. Just before you begin, there were some questions about funding sources that came up while Representative Cannon and Bailey were up. So I just want to see if I can identify Paul Siebert from LFO. He is here. Okay, good. We'll have you
at the end. Good. I wanted to know you were here. Please go ahead.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amanda Rich, and I represent the Oregon Recreation and Park Association. I represent the interests of all public park and recreation agencies in Oregon. I really appreciate the opportunity to get to take part in this discussion. There's been a little bit of talk of you know, who was at the table, who wasn't at the table, and I can say that parks were definitely not at the table in this. I respect my colleagues that signed the agreement, but they were representing themselves and not representing parks. So, again, glad to be here and glad to talk to you about this, and hope that if we go forward and we get an opportunity to sit down and work some of the issues on this measure, that we'll be able to be at the table for that. We have great sympathy for the concerns that are driving this effort and driving this referral. We understand and are you know, suffering with you as we face this great crisis that our state is facing, and I would not want to be in your shoes making the decisions that you are having to make. And therefore, like I said, we are sympathetic to and understand the needs behind this. We do have one concern that I'd like to put on the record right now, and that is with the mechanism of the safety valve. As you can see from the memo that was provided by Representative Bailey and Co-Chair Cannon, the safety valve is written on the same with the same criteria as is used to access the Education Stability Fund. I would posit that this fund is not analogous to the Education Stability Fund, and that the Education Stability Fund was passed by the voters to be a savings account and to be a fund that was intended to be accessed. And I think, as I said, it's understandable that that the desire to want to be able to access these dedicated funds in times of great economic distress. However, it seems to me that with a fund that has been dedicated by the voters twice to specific programmatic purposes and was not designated as a savings account, that we might want to consider a greater threshold. We might want to consider a set of criteria that is just a little bit harder than what we are setting for ourselves for a fund that is really a savings account. I think I'll you know, close my testimony at this time. Again, I really hope that we'd be able to be a part of any conversations as they go forward. Appreciate the efforts of the legislators who are working on this, and I'll take any questions at this time.
Are there any questions? Please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Ms. Evans, were you present in the meeting with Legislative Council around drafting of HGR 29?
There was one meeting prior to the election where we discussed the agreement, and that included Jessica Adamson of then-Speaker Hunt's office and Harrison Conley. That was prior to the, as I said, prior to the election. Other than that, I'd have to check a calendar for a date. The outcome of that meeting was, frankly, agreeing that we couldn't agree on what the technical fix language meant, and an agreement that would Speaker Hunt's staff would reconvene us later to discuss it, and that didn't happen.
Well, Ms. Evans referenced in her testimony a couple of references to a portion of the agreement. I just want to read it into the record so it's here. It says, flexibility in the share between state agency and non-state agency grants that will protect the general fund from any impacts from reductions to state agencies, in case the committee is interested in what the exact language of that agreement was. And I believe that we could probably have a long conversation of what the meaning of is, but my hope is that the groups, that Nature Conservancy will come back and honor the agreement that was signed in good faith.
I know a guy you can call, give me the answer to that.
Other questions for these three before us? If not, I want to thank all three of you for coming and for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to call up Tom O'Brien and Jerry Nicholson and Paul Reed, please. Identify yourself for the record, and however you'd like to start is fine.
Apparently I will.
Okay.
For the record, Tom O'Brien of the Network of Oregon Watershed Councils, co-chairs, committee members. The Network of Oregon Watershed Councils represents over 90 councils which convene and organize people at the local level to address difficult, seemingly intractable conservation issues. What was a polarized, adversarial, and litigious approach is now a process based on conversations between people, conversations built on trust, transparency, and a spirit of mutual gains. Today, these conservation issues are addressed in a spirit of cooperation and collaboration, meeting environmental, economic, and community goals, what we call the triple bottom line. Over the last 12 years, Oregon has demonstrated the power of fueling a restoration economy through dedicated grant money without any impact to the tax base, and it has accomplished this through empowering people and communities, building upon a conservation culture and ethic that will far outlast the cyclical nature and political limitations of top-down solutions. To engage stakeholders, build trust, identify common problems, reach consensus, craft local solutions, and apply restorative actions, there have had to be many conversations between people, conversations that find middle ground between seemingly polarized interests. If the grant funds are the fuel of Oregon's watershed approach and restoration economy, the conversations and the spirit of consensus and mutual gains is the fabric that holds this whole thing together. So I'm here to ask you today, who has been a part of this conversation? The network has been aware of a limited negotiation between a few parties that has in effect produced a resolution, HJR 29, that would significantly alter ballot measure 76, a measure that was passed in November by a majority of voters in every county in Oregon. For the record, I'm not here today to obstruct what might be well-intentioned efforts at establishing good public policy. However, in the few days that HJR 29 has been publicly available, we can't even discern what the actual problems are with Measure 76 that this joint resolution is supposed to fix. Reaching consensus around the problem should be requisite to proposing solutions. In the spirit of the watershed approach, we ask this committee to daylight this process and broaden the opportunity for many more interested conservation organizations to participate, organizations that represent tens of thousands of Oregonians. Measure 76 was designed to continue Oregon's conservation legacy. To undo it in this way would be a travesty. Please give this resolution the full consideration that it deserves by allowing for a conversation that might bring many people to the middle, as opposed to limited negotiations and a fast legislative track that could otherwise undermine the fragile trust that it has taken Oregonians so long to build. Thank you.
Chairman Gilliam, Chairman Cannon, my name is Jerry Nicolescu. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. And the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts is opposed to House Joint Resolution 29 as it is written now. The Association opposes the resolution based upon two specific constitutional changes indicated in the resolution. The first is the reduction in the amount of funding the Assembly will appropriate to the Natural Resources subaccount at OWEB from 65% to 58%, based upon a projected amount of approximately $55 million to the Natural Resources subaccount grant side in this next biennium. The decrease could equate approximately 10% in the amount of available grant funds. This loss of funding could be implemented on the ground in local communities through districts and watershed councils. A University of Oregon study indicated natural resource restoration project managers hire 95 to 99% of the work through Oregon-based businesses, typically local companies and contractors. In addition, every dollar spent locally in restoration attracts another $1.48 from state or federal programs, local groups, and landowners. Depending on whether you believe every dollar spent in the community turns over 3 to 7 times, that would indicate a possible impact of approximately $18 to $42 million. The second issue is in Section 4B of the same in the resolution, and that is the portion where OWEB could pay for its cost of administration. from the grant side. If OWEB was required to pay the cost of this administration from the grant side, there's another approximate $6 million that would no longer be available to be implemented on the ground. If you add in the multiplying factors mentioned above, the loss of the economy grows larger, and more importantly, the pace of natural resource progress slows considerably. OACD does not think the proposed changes are beneficial to the ability of OWEB, Conservation District, and Watershed Council efforts to protect or restore habitat, protect or restore watersheds, and to carry out the necessary assessment, planning, design, and technical assistance for projects. The proposed changes begin to move funding further away from the vital support of local program delivery and project implementation. However, having said that, we are very agreeable to and willing to be a part of any discussion that will bring about a solution to our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, and members of the committee. My name is Paul Reed. I'm an elected director with the Upper Willamette Soil and Water Conservation District in Lane County. Make no mistake about it, given the legislature's history with the funds on the operating side of ballot measure 66 and the language that's built into HJR 29, we're talking about a permanent diminishing of the amount of money that's available for on-the-ground projects. Oregon's 45 soil and water conservation districts are the primary on-the-ground implementers of the Agricultural Water Quality Management Act of 1993, commonly called SB 1010. Additionally, the SWCDs and Oregon's watershed councils are your on-the-ground troops who actually do the work. And this would represent a significant diminishing of the funds required or available to do that work. All of the on-the-ground activities are financed by a combination of Oregon Lottery money and the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund money, which, by the way, requires a 33% local in-kind match, which is that money, that activity that we're performing is what's contributing to that local match. Our activities are essential for compliance with the Federal Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, Agricultural Water Quality Management, and the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. With the exception of the 13 SWCDs who have local tax bases, the SWCDs and the Watershed Councils would not exist without the money coming from the ballot measure 76 lottery money. With HJR 29, there are two personal directions for you to consider. If you want to significantly weaken the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, then you should vote for approval of HJR 29. If you want to reduce the quality of water and fish and wildlife habitats in the state, then you should vote for approval of HJR 29. If you want to potentially eliminate the required 33% local match for the Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Fund and lose that federal funding, then you should vote for approval of HJR 29. If you want to eliminate several hundred jobs around Oregon, then you should vote for HJR 29. If you want to see a significantly complex issue decided by a very few in a fast-track process, then you should vote for approval of HJR 29. Finally, if you want to nullify the wishes of the vast majority of Oregon voters who voted for ballot measure 76 in 2010, then you should vote for approval of HJR 29. Or, if you care about clean water, the environment, fish and wildlife, and local jobs, and want to see continuation of the restoration and protection of the environment by the on-the-ground actions of Soil and Water Conservation and District and Watershed Councils, then you should vote against adoption of HJR 29. If you want to continue the progress each year on fulfillment of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, then you should vote against adoption of HJR 29. The choice is yours. Thank you.
Thank you. How about questions for any of these three witnesses? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious if you think your members would support either a sunset or a change to the device so that in the event of an emergency, and I don't mean a leveling when our economy drops, but I mean a true emergency, would they support such a change?
Speaking off the cuff, if you will, here, my membership
would support some of the good public policy components of this. And in fact, the idea of a sunset date and being able to activate all such dedicated funds in true emergencies, we would certainly consider on the table. And it really is the lack of a case being made for the redistribution of funds, and what I think is fairly vague and perhaps unacceptable language presently with respect to the emergency access of those funds. So I think we need more time as a group to consider the resolution and come up with a smarter public policy component to it. So in short answer to your question, the answer would be yes, but with a more open and thorough review of the entire agreement. We don't feel bound by the agreement made by a few.
Any other comments or questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biz, I would tend to echo Tom's remarks and say that the districts would probably support the same issues.
One follow-up.
Please.
I called 9 Soil and Water Conservation District members last night to get their feeling on this bill. And one of the things they continually mentioned was that they were unhappy that under the OWEB column, when they were given a grant, they were not generally given the money to administer it themselves. And they had to go dig that money up somewhere else. And so in the revisiting of this, if that's what happens, is that something that you think should be discussed?
Co-chairs Gilliam and Representative Bentz, I would suggest that certainly that's an issue for all the grant recipients, but those have been limitations, I think, that are more part of administrative rules. And I think to get to that level of detail in legislation might not be fruitful. It might be a Pandora's box, if you will, of a lot of administrative rules associated with the grant process. That issue itself, though, is of great concern to all the grantees.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions from the committee? If not, thank you all three for being here today. We've got a couple folks that we'd like to come up, only one of which is in the room at the moment. So if you don't mind, Mr. Siebert, if you'd come up. And committee, I've got a couple of questions for Mr. Siebert, as already mentioned, as a legislative analyst for LFO, but I'm happy to defer to others first, if you have it.
I do. I'm also...
Co-Chair Cannon, please.
Thanks. Thanks, Paul.
He has to identify, sorry.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Paul Siebert, Legislative Fiscal Office.
Great. So there's been considerable discussion about what might be the impacts of budgeting under the Measure 76 constraints. Could you talk about how you arrived at, I believe, your conclusion that there would be a potential $8.5 million hole that we'd have to plug in the Natural Resource Agencies with the passage of Measure 76, absent what we're proposing in HJR 29?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon. That was done just by simply looking at what was funded under Measure 66 in the current biennium, and then looking at if those programs would be eligible under the new split of 35-65. Under Measure 66, state agency programs are eligible under either column. On the capital side, it's much more difficult because of the restrictions in the Constitution for those expenditures of those dollars. But as has been mentioned before, a couple programs have been moved on to the capital side, most notably the fish screens and then some of the weed control activities and weed control grants in the Department of Agriculture. So that kind of $8 to $8.5 million impact was simply just overlaying 09-11 expenditures on the new regime under Measure 76.
Follow up for second question. To your knowledge, there was allusion to the Treasurer's office having a different approach to this, maybe the governor's office. To your knowledge, can the legislature use anyone besides an arbiter for this, anyone besides your office? I mean, I'm trying to wrap my head around the fact that there may be some competing ways to think about this, and what insight can you share on that?
Mr. Chairman, Ken, I'm not sure if I understand your question. Are you talking about the process for doing fiscal impacts of ballot measures?
I think that Ms. Evans referred to the fact that the Treasurer's Office may have had some way of analyzing this measure that that concluded there was not general fund impact. And I'm wondering what binds us as we budget, what analysis binds our decisions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, you're not bound by doing any backfilling of general funding into these programs. In fact, in the more than 9 years I've worked on natural resource agency budgets, I never assumed that general fund will be added back to a natural resource agency. There are a lot of other, there are other options. One could, the body could, removes or eliminate some of the activities that are currently funded under Measure 66 that don't fit under Measure 76. One could, as the, as was alluded to earlier, find other sources of revenue to fund some of these programs. For example, in the governor's recommended budget, he used a significant portion of the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds to fund some of these activities. We've funded some of these activities on the PCSRF or Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds in the past as well. So, I mean, there are certainly a number of options open to the body when dealing with the whole.
And I guess I may not have put my question very well, but what I thought I heard Nan Evans suggest was that there was another way of looking at this, which would allow these dollars to be used such that the hole didn't emerge in the first place. And I apologize to Ms. Evans if I'm mischaracterizing the way she was presenting the information. But I want some understanding of whose analysis of the situation we have to use. I mean, we have a memo from you that I'm happy to share, which says, here's the situation. Measure 76 passed. You will not be able to use those 65% dollars for these purposes that you used them in the previous biennium. Is that
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, the Legislative Fiscal Office is the staff of your Ways and Means Committee, which does the budget ultimately for this body.
Okay, so. Thank you. And my final point, our final question, there was reference to a sort of permanent, I think in the testimony from the representative of the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, a permanent diminishing of grants for those watershed activities. What's the history of OWEB grants, just in sort of raw dollars? Where has it been, and where would it head under HJR 29?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, certainly before the addition of line games, the revenue was much smaller than it is now. The addition of line games to the Oregon Lottery created a significant increase in lottery revenues, which also translated to the automatic dedication of 15% of those to parks and natural resources, which meant a large increase in those dedications and those expenditures of those dollars over the last few biennia.
And hello. And so I don't know if you have the numbers in front of you, but if OWEB grants in 2009-11, I believe, were in the order of $46 million. And I'm wondering, under HJR 29, what would be available for OWEB grants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, the OWEB grants, the $46 million you're referring to were the capital grants. Again, remember, under Measure 66, the money is bifurcated, capital and non-capital. So you cannot pay for grants for things like education or general monitoring or watershed assessments under the 65% capital funding. So there were two grant funds, and traditionally have usually been two grant funds in OWEB, a capital and a non-capital. The capital you're referring to is the $46 million. In 2009-11, they also had $4 million of non-capital grant fund for those types of grants I just described, education and those non-capital eligible grants.
And in 11-13?
Well, in 11-13, it based on just the, I guess it would be around $55 million is the 35%. The governor's budget assumed that some of the weed grants made by ODA would fit underneath that 65%. So, for example, in the governor's recommended budget, it has about 52.7. But the dedication of 65%, would be about $55 or $56 million, depending on what happens to the lottery forecast.
And if it was shifted from 65 to 58 as this measure, and I recognize this gets to a level of detail and sort of a ways and means type of way that I'm not sure the committee wants to go, but it is sort of the central question before us. If we were to shift from 65 to 58, where does that put the OEB?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that figure in front of me right now. But I would also note that there are three former and one current member of Natural Resources Ways and Means Subcommittee on your committee today. You have a lot of experience.
Thanks.
Mr. Siebert, just to go back and clarify this, and you're right, you know, you are part of the office that's responsible for the final budget, which is our responsibility. Yet, I would note that this governor's recommended budget may be more relevant than any other as long as I've been in the building. So I think it's worth going back over this. In his, which is important to our calculations and negotiations, how does he cover this shortfall, the main shortfall that we're talking about in this issue?
Mr. Chair, in the governor's recommended budget, they, of course, now I'm speaking for the governor's budget, but in the governor's budget, he uses primarily Pacific Coastal SAM recovery funds to fund the activities, the state agency activities that don't fit under the 35%. And in fact, he overshifts agency activities that were on lottery dollars onto federal funds so that he can put a few of his new initiatives on the Measure 76 35%, including some money for marine reserves, for implementation of the conservation strategy, and then some money for Forest Health Collaborative in the Department of Forestry.
Okay, I wanted to make sure I understood that part. There are other options which you've already discussed in questions with Representative Cannon, which I think is important for the committee. Comments, questions for this? Please, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We received testimony that suggested that passage of HJR 29 could either directly or indirectly lead to the federal government taking over water quality and potentially a salmon recovery. And I think Mr. Siebert, the diversion of salmon recovery funds, do you foresee any impact on federal mandates for salmon recovery?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I would not try to read the mind of the federal agencies that are providing federal funds to us, to the state. But we work very hard in the past, have worked very hard to ensure that any state expenditure of Pacific Coastal SAM recovery funds meet the eligibility and the requirements that the federal government imposes on those funds. And we will continue to do so as we move forward in the budget process.
Thank you. Follow up?
Absolutely.
We also received testimony that HJR 29 would result in the loss of employment around our state. Do you know what the employment impact might possibly be with a loss of $7 to $7.5 million to state natural resource departments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, no, I don't. I don't have that information in front of me.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This isn't directed at you, Paul. I just wanted to say that Representative Witt has brought up a really interesting point, and we've spent a lot of time, money, and effort on part of both the state and the feds and the private citizens of Oregon in the form of watershed councils, soil and water districts, et cetera, and a lot of private timber and public timber, too, lands doing things that improve habitat for fish. We put a lot of effort into trying to keep away from the feds ending up managing our fish. And so whatever we do, and I'm not suggesting anything on this bill or anything, but whatever we do, we should keep that in mind so we don't undo it and become vulnerable to having the federal government end up telling us what we do and then having spent all this time and effort only to end up what we tried not to do in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Siebert.
And I'd like to call up Stephen Cafori and finally give him a chance. Mr. Cafori, I said you could go first. You are last. Isn't there a great scripture about that? Anyway, welcome. Just identify yourself and tell us what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the courtesy of trying to get me on early ahead of your colleagues. They didn't let you get away with it. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here today representing the Trust for Public Land. Trust for Public Land is a national land trust. We, like a number of other organizations in the state, some very large and some very small, purchase land from willing sellers and then sell that land at fair market value, sell that land at fair market value to state and local government and federal government agencies for conservation purposes. Some of that will be used for parks, some will be used for habitat, some will be used in a combination of those. I'm not speaking on behalf or really to this measure as a whole. I want to talk about an amendment that I want to bring forth. We have experienced, those of us who are involved in land conservation, difficulties with an OWEB requirement that they say is forced upon them by the Attorney General's office. And because the Attorney General says that this is a constitutional issue and not a statutory issue, the only way to address this problem is with a constitutional amendment. I've been working with Representative Hunt's office to get some language that would fit into this because the subject matter is essentially the same. This is the money that comes from Valid Measure 76, goes to purchase land. We want to make sure that that's done in an expeditious and efficient manner as possible. The problem is that, I'll try to be brief and not technical on this, that OWEB requires that a conservation easement be given back to the state of Oregon from any ultimate purchaser of the land. And this raises a number of problems. The biggest problem is with federal and tribal agencies that, for obvious reasons, do not want to have purchase a land that has an encumbrance that's owned by the state. There are also some problems that occur when we are, OWEB is producing a small portion of a large project. Suppose that there was recently in Tigard, for example, we bought a project from the school district of Tigard. There was about $5 million, and we asked OWEB for $1 million of that. And we got into the other money was coming from the local voters in Tigard, from the Tigard City, come from a number of sources. We eventually decided not to use the OWEB money, which forced the city of Tigard to dig into its own money, citizen development charges and other things to pay for that, to cover that, because of this requirement of the conservation easement requirement. What our amendment would do is not to require anybody to do anything but to give OWEB more flexibility and say that they would be using, in their judgment, the proper kind of protection, depending on who the ultimate purchaser was, to make sure that the state's interest was protected, but on the other hand, to balance that with the need to use what the tools that are proper for the instance and not inhibit us from purchasing land where the public interest would say that land ought to be purchased.
Thank you, Mr. Cafori. You bring up yet another issue that I didn't understand was part of this discussion. But just to be clear for you, you mentioned an amendment, which I don't think we have.
You're correct, Mr. Chair. It's in the process of being drafted. I've been working with LCI.
Okay. And I'm going to have a few more comments, but just in regard to that, so people know, Co-Chair Cannon and I have agreed that we will not work this bill today. We may have a discussion here in a moment and stand down, but I just wanted to be clear to everyone in the room, we're not working the bill today. But in the future, obviously, we'll have a chance to discuss yours or other amendments that may or may not be related. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Coach Gilliam. Just a brief comment to say that I really appreciate the Trust for Public Land and Oregon League of Conservation Voters. I know those are organizations you're both part of, Mr. Cafori, that have been working very, very hard to find an agreement on this, and appreciate your hard work.
Thank you.
Are there other comments? Thank you, Mr. Cafori. Committee, if you'll indulge me just for a second, I wanted to at least give some indication of where I am as a result of this testimony. And I want to say first that it's a strange thing to be in this seat with colleagues that are obviously on the bill, and I don't see a clear path of opposition to this bill in the building. And I see, from my perspective, and again, this may not be yours, I see two, you know, separate issues that I sort of alluded to when I asked Representative Bailey a question. You know, clearly, the substance of the bill is the most important thing, and the funding and the agencies and a number of issues that none of us want to see obliterated simply by not moving forward. The other part of it is the track and the schedule and the form, and that part puzzles me. I have only the highest respect for Representative Bailey and Cannon and their integrity. So this is not in any way to be interpreted otherwise. I think it's different. Doesn't mean anything wrong with it. I think it's different to go about this way, and I thought you both had good answers to why you did that. But it brings me to a conclusion, at least from this is just my opinion. The question keeps in my mind is why the rush for this particular election cycle? There is another election after that. I'm not saying yay or nay to that, but it seems to make more sense to me. Partly because of the way we did it, but also there's a part in that agreement, and there are all very reputable folks who have signed that agreement, and there are folks in the room who say they weren't part of that process, which is bound to happen when you have stakeholders as diverse as we do in our states. But there's a part in that agreement that's very interesting. None of us could have anticipated. You referenced your town halls. We all went through a campaign, and this is not a political statement, but I thought I was so clever in my town halls when I would say, regarding the mix of the House, you know what I would really like to see is a 30-30 split. I thought that was so clever. Well, here I sit with co-chair Cannon. So, there's a reference in the agreement to the leadership. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know for the first time in 152 years we would be even, Stephen. So this is a different climate, one that we didn't create individually, but that we are in. And all I am trying to say, in a very long-winded way, I'm sorry, but I guess that's what happens when you put chair by somebody's name, is this, that I think there is another way. I am not certain I will be the leader down that path. I went into Representative Benz's office to talk about this a few days ago, and he got out his grease board and started in with the funding options and the percentages, and we ran out of, it was great, I mean, nothing wrong with was wrong with my ability to absorb it. We almost ran out of ink for his board. This is complicated, and it's important. And I commit to further discussion and to finding a way through that doesn't, to Representative Boone's admonition that we don't throw everything out and end up being vulnerable to losing some very valuable things that are in this agreement. But for my part, I don't want to rush because things are different and it's very complicated, and I think we ought to move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate those comments, and I think they're spot on. It is things have changed in the ways that you've noted, and I think it is important to broaden the conversation so that we can move forward together. And if giving this some additional time seems like the way to do that, I think that's what we'll do. I would note that the reason for some sense of urgency around this is because it affects how we are able to budget for 2011-13. And absent some understanding about the ultimate disposition of Measure 76 and a subsequent referral, we won't be in a position, our hands will be tied in certain respects around this budget. We'll have this $8.5 million hold. So that's my reason for pressing, urging the committee to move quickly on this. That doesn't mean a work session today. I hope it does mean a work session soon, and you and I can certainly talk about when that might be.
Thank you for those comments. If you'll indulge me one more moment, because this co-chair dynamic is a very important one, and I'm going to stand down just for a minute, and then we'll return.
And stand at ease, you want to tap
the stand at ease, and I keep, it's not recess, it's stand at ease. And we shall be back. Let's see.
order.
And I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry for all that drama for very little.
Do tell.
And, but I am now going to, before I do, I'm going to say that we are committed to working forward on this issue, and for now we are closing the public hearing on HDR 29. Thank you all for being here.
And close the committee.
And I'd also like to close the committee meeting of the House Energy, Environment, and Water.